Curtis Lewa.
Their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
You can't start a fire.
Seven minutes after the hour of 5. Yours truly, Curtis Sliwa, taking you on the drive home at 5. And who is it that's dancing in the dark across the Hudson River in New Jersey? Boss Bruce Springsteen, who I hate, I loathe, I despise. Yeah, I'm not going to Broadway watching any Bruce Springsteen performances like Shamu El Jefe. Chris Christie has said he will do on the very first day. He's finally out of office. Good riddance. But dancing in the dark. Who dances in the dark in New Jersey? Let me connect the timeline for you. With the latest act of terrorism against us here in New York City by Uzbeki bomber boy, right? Because his intention was eventually maybe to try to fashion a bomb like some of his heroes of past lore who also were residing in New Jersey. So what Uzbeki boy did was he came in from the Central Asian Republics in 2010, settled first in Cincinnati, then did a hop, skip, and a jump down to Tampa, and then ended up on Genesee Street in Paterson, New Jersey. Genesee Street. In fact, that's where his wife and children were. That's where he was an Uber driver. Made 1,400 trips, and imagine how many people now looking at his face have said, oh my God, that was my Uber driver. I had no idea. Not only that, but he would schlep out of the house every day to bow towards Mecca and Medina in the mosque right on that block on Genesee Street, a mosque that had been under surveillance by the NYPD for many years, particularly in the administration of Michael Bloomberg, when Police Commissioner Kelly was in charge. And they had a special 1,000-person unit of the NYPD housed over at the Bush Terminal. Right there, if you notice, near Sunset Park, as you look at the East River from the Brooklyn side over to the Manhattan side, you see the old Bush Terminal. Yeah, they were housed there. And they did surveillance on potential terrorist actions that could affect us here in New York City, which, as you know, is target number one for all jihadists everywhere. But when you connect the dots, you notice, like in the case of this Uzbeki boy, he was living in Paterson, undetected. Huh. Recently, we had the situation in Chelsea, the Chelsea bomber. Remember, he rolled that, wheeled in that pressure cooker bomber and set it off and tried to kill and maim as many people as possible. Gee, where was he residing? Oh, that's right, Elizabeth, New Jersey. And remember, he was testing out his paraphernalia in the backyard of that halal chicken shack that he was working at. You know, that fried chicken joint. Gee, Elizabeth, New Jersey. And then let's move even further back. Let's move back to 1991. 1991, there was El Said Nosair, an employee of the Board of Education of New York. He did boiler repairs. Well, that's right. The Board of Education, the old one on 110 Livingston Street that Rudy Giuliani said should have been blasted off its foundations. And Rudy was right about that. But El Said Nosair took a gun and went to a meeting that Maya Kahani of the JDL was speaking at in a Midtown hotel and killed him in cold-blooded murder. Where was El Said Nosair living at the time? Cliffside Park. In a high-rise condominium amongst Alta Kaka Jews who had no idea. Yeah, I had no idea he was a terrorist. Yeah, living amongst us. Yeah. But notice, not on the New York City side, living in New Jersey. Who was his cousin? His cousin was Ramzi Youssef. Who is Ramzi Youssef? I got to remind you, take you back on the timeline, 1993. Remember the first attack on the World Trade Center site? Ramzi Youssef, who was living where? In New York City? No. He was living in Jersey City with a lot of his co-conspirators who were living in all different parts of New Jersey at the time, including those who assembled the bomb that they put in that rental rider truck that they drove into the bowels of the World Trade Center and then lit a wick, ran away, and the devastation almost toppled the World Trade Center, one of the towers. I believe there were six people killed, many, many injured. And it was the catalyst, the motivation for another cousin. That's right. They were like three-eyed cousin fornicators, all of Ramzi Youssef's relatives. Sheikh Rahman. Ah, you remember the name, huh? Sheikh Rahman. Who was Sheikh Rahman? Think back. He was the inspiration for that first attack on the World Trade Center shot. In fact, he was the blind-eyed, Santa Claus hat-wearing imam of hate, Sheikh Rahman. Where was he living at the time? Jersey City. What was the mosque that he was preaching from? On Park Street in Jersey City. See, Jersey has become a sanctuary for the jihadists. And the reason I bring this to everyone's attention is, why are these jihadists, why are these men, some of them independent and autonomous from one another, why are they always seeking to live in New Jersey and not within the five boroughs of New York City or in Orange County or anywhere else in the Mid-Hudson Valley or out in Nassau County or in Suffolk County? It's because they're under great scrutiny when they're on this side of the Hudson in New York, led first by the NYPD that is super aggressive in trying to root them out. But what exists in New Jersey? Almost nothing. From the state police to the county sheriff's departments to the local police departments. And in fact, I remember that day in which Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, the governor, who loves jihadists and terrorists because he's embraced them to his bosom, approached the attorney general in Barack Obama's administration and said to him, I want civil rights charges filed against Michael Bloomberg and against Police Commissioner Kelly for encroaching upon our turf and sending undercover Muslim-speaking police officers from the NYPD into the mosques in Patterson, in Newark, in New Brunswick, and in Jersey City. That's right. It was Shamu El Jefe Chris Christie who wanted civil rights violations filed by the Department of Justice against Bloomberg and Kelly. And then we remember the attack on 9/11. Where were many of the co-conspirators staying at that time? In a town right next to Patterson, where Uzbeki Boy was on Genesee Street, it was called West Patterson. As a result of six of the co-conspirators staying in West Patterson, and then they were going to all kinds of strip joints in Clifton and getting brumskis, and they were getting lap dances, and they were leading a decadent, debaucherous lifestyle, as were the rules of the Al-Qaeda Osama bin Laden handbook so that they could blend into the general population. But it left such a stigma on the town and city of West Patterson that they decided in the aftermath of 9/11 to change their name. I forget what bucolic name they chose. But right now, it's no longer West Patterson, New Jersey. Woodland Park, that's right. Woodland Park. Sounds very waspy, right? But you see no affiliation to Patterson, New Jersey. But then when you looked at all the co-conspirators, close to 19 of them, many were residing in New Jersey as they waited the signal to come from Osama bin Laden, the mastermind, to a man who is now actually housed in Gitmo, hopefully perpetually until life does he part, when he jumps on the Paradise Express and beams himself up to Allah's side and then has sex with 72 vessel virgins. He is the schmuck of all schmucks. He is the sheikh, as he is referred to, who happens to be the cousin of, yes, again, the three-eyed cousin fornicators, Ramzi Youssef, who was, again, the mastermind of the first attack in 1993. So I ask all of you out there, now that we have been targeted again, the first major terrorist attack in the aftermath of 9/11 on New York City turf, why is it that New Jersey is not doing its fair share in reining in terrorists? I'll bet you if you look at the percentile of those who have attacked us so far, from going back to the assassination of Meir Kahane in 1991 that triggered all of this by El Said Nosseir living in Cliffside Park, and then the attack against the World Trade Center, the first one in 1993, the mastermind Ramzi Youssef living in Jersey City with many of his cohorts, quickly followed up by the attack. Eventually, there was a total success, the attack of 9/11, in which many of the co-conspirators were living in West Paterson, New Jersey, and then the Chelsea bomber living in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and now Uzbeki boy living in Paterson, New Jersey. I'm asking, what the hell are New Jersey public safety authorities doing to rein in these jihadists? In fact, New Jersey is not just a sanctuary state for illegal aliens. I declare it to be a sanctuary state for wannabe jihadists. Because you're not going to live in New York City. You're not going to live in New York State. You're under too much scrutiny. If you want to run out and about and slip through the cracks and plan your jihadist actions, best to live somewhere in New Jersey, where Shamu El Jefe Chris Christie put a block to any incursions into, quote, his turf by members of the elite division of the Muslim-worshipping, Arabic-speaking NYPD undercover operation that operated in that mosque on Genesee Street that Uzbeki boy went to on a regular basis to bow to Mecca and Medina, and went into the mosques in Newark and New Brunswick and the Jersey City mosques of Sheikh Abdel Ahmed Rahman, the blind-eyed cleric of hate who was wearing his Santa Claus hat and his black glasses as he planned jihad against the evil Satan of America and the little Satan of Israel.
Curtis Sliwa, the deepest knowledge of the city.
He'll be the next mayor of the city of New York.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
5:25, back on Monday, we saw that Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, was able to get indictments against the former campaign manager of the Donald Trump campaign, Manafort, his business associate, and a guy who was a foreign policy advisor, Papadopoulos. But on the line to discuss it and possibly the legal strategy ahead for both sides is Arthur Idala. You've seen him on TV. You've heard him here on WABC as a legal analyst and obviously as a practicing trial attorney. Thanks for jumping on board the Drive at 5 again, Artie.
How are you, Mr. Sliwa?
I've had better days. But in what we're now learning about Manafort, he had three separate passports, fake name, God only knows where he was parking his money in Malta and Cyprus. What does this say about the direction that Mueller is going in?
Well, it seemed like Manafort was the low-hanging fruit in terms of if they wanted to get someone associated with the President of the United States who they could charge with a very serious crime where he's facing major time in jail, who will then flip. And as you know, Curtis, as a scholar of the criminal justice system, that all started, 20-some-odd years ago with your friend, the Honorable Sammy the Bull Gravano, right? That's the blueprint. You find a guy who's close to the target that you want, who is susceptible to tremendous criminal charges. You charge him, and then you squeeze him. And you say, here's your choice. You spend life in prison, or you tell us what we want to know about our target, and we'll help you out. And that's exactly the blueprint they follow. Before Sammy the Bull, everyone kept their mouth shut. And if it meant you did life in prison, you did life in prison. But he opened up the floodgates, and he gave the feds and law enforcement the blueprint to how they solve these cases. And if you read carefully the indictment, there's a mention there about Manafort's children somewhat being involved, although they're not charged. And, you know, everyone has an inherent instinct to protect their children. So even if Manafort wants to be a tough guy and say, listen, I'm not saying anything about anyone, once you start bringing into his son and daughter-in-law into it, that may change if he actually has something to say.
Well, I noticed he may
have nothing to say.
I noticed, Arthur, in today's New York Times, they had a huge piece on Andrew Weissman, who had taken down Vinny the Chin Gigante. He's one of the main prosecutors for Mueller. So they're using basically organized crime tactics when they were prosecuting them.
Absolutely. It comes right out of their playbook. And everyone here in the city knows who Andrew is. And he's a fine lawyer. And he's representing Papadopoulos. No, he's not representing Papadopoulos. He's representing Manafort or Manafort's partner. I forget which one is he. I know he's in the mix. But, I mean, he knows, believe me, he knows what he's doing. He knows the game. The issue that no one's really addressing is, maybe Manafort's got nothing to say. In other words, maybe the president of the United States did nothing wrong. Or maybe people around him did something wrong. But maybe, quite possibly, he did nothing wrong. And, you know, just to add a little bit to the whole fake news aspect of things, if you go online right now, like I just did to prepare for this segment, there are all of these articles about how furious Donald Trump is, how furious he is, and heads were going to roll, and he was apoplectic. And then while I'm doing the research 10 minutes ago to be on your show, a New York Times thing just pops up that the President of the United States just called him and had a very pleasant conversation. He said he was very calm, that he's not mad at anyone, that he's not angry with anyone, that he's enjoying his time as President of the United States. He starts early, works late, and he really enjoying it. He's looking forward to this trip. So I don't know what to believe, Curtis. I mean, that's the truth. I know what's right. What's in the indictment, we have to believe that a portion of that is true. People in Washington say that Manafort played it pretty fast and loose in general outside of his relationship with the President of the United States. And no one seems to be very surprised that he has been indicted, having nothing to do with Donald Trump, but things of his own business practice.
All right, but the other guy that we really didn't know about, Papadopoulos, who had been a foreign policy advisor for Trump during the campaign, he was demeaned, ridiculed by supporters of Trump as nothing more than a guy you would fetch coffee for guys having a meeting. And yet, he flipped. He actually acknowledged his guilt to lying to the FBI and was probably wearing a wire for months, picking up conversations of the very same guys who are calling him coffee boy now.
And again, that's not unheard of. Once again, it comes out of the organized crime playbook in terms of prosecuting them. And quite frankly, Curtis, I'm not blowing smoke. You know more about those cases than I do. There was that one guy, he brought down a whole family with his Rolex watch was actually a recording device. I think his street name was Cookie or something like that. So, yeah, that's what they do. They find the lowest hanging fruit, and then they work up.
Papadopoulos,
who's 29 years old, and they bring down the tremendous weight and power of the federal government, and they say, look, kid, you better find us something. If you have nothing to give us, you know, hello, Marion, where is it, Colorado, and you'll be in the...
Oh, Supermax, Florence.
Right.
That's
exactly,
right.
Exactly, Florence.
All right, but lastly, because he was wired up, let's say he had some incriminating documentary evidence on audio. You bring that person in for, you know, just an interview. The person lies to whoever the prosecutor is that's assigned to that person. And then they play the audio and they say, gotcha. And then they get that person to become a cooperator. And it's sort of like one after another, correct?
Correct. It's how the dominoes drop until, you know, a couple of things could happen. Until somebody, they get him and he has nothing else to offer. He's the last domino and there's nothing, he has no further information, which is what Roger Stone, Manafort's former business partner, someone who apparently is very close with the president, is what he's saying. He's like, listen, the president of the United States has nothing to worry about. For two reasons. Number one, Manafort has nothing to say that's the truth. So that's one reason why he doesn't have to be concerned. But the other thing is Manafort's not the kind of guy who's going to lie and make things up. Because you know, Curtis, sometimes when your culions, as you like to say, are in a vice and your whole world is crashing down, well, you might say a little fib, which turns into a lie, which turns into a whole blown-up story that then, you know, sometimes law enforcement, that's the story they want to hear. And a person gets a benefit, and someone who didn't do anything wrong winds up going to jail for it. So we have a great criminal justice system, but it is far from perfect, my friend.
Do appreciate that. That's Arthur Idala giving you insight into the strategy behind Mueller's prosecution techniques, and obviously how a guy like Papadopoulos, who nobody really knew about, could lead to taking out a lot of people in the Trump administration. Oh, yeah, since he was wired up. Like a Chris.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Guardian Angel found a Curtis Sliwa.
Really trying to help our cause.
WABCRadio.com.
Keep it suit up. If you bottles don't want to dance on board, then keep it true up. I'm gangster when I pull my fuerza.
Degenerate reggaeton monsters here. This is the English version of the MS-13 recruiting song, which is most popular in Spanish. But they dominate. They dominate street gangs. It's a paramilitary organization. You think you snuff them out in one spot, like recently we thought, with the renewed cooperation of federal authorities and local authorities in Suffolk. It was certainly making way in crippling MS-13. But now we've seen, just in the last 2 weeks, three bodies unearthed in Nassau County who turn out to be victims of MS-13 violence. There's another 17 Latinos still missing between the ages of about 15 to 22. 10 of them are thought possibly to have been victims of MS-13. And now a call for all hands on deck by the guy who would like to become the next Nassau County executive to replace Mangano this November 7th in the general election, Jack Martins, who is the Republican candidate. He's also, I believe, on the Conservative Party line and the Reform Party line. Thanks for joining us here on the Drive Home at 5, Jack.
Great to be with you, Curtis. Thank you.
Okay, so it's looking like the strength of MS-13, which was being crunched on in Suffolk County by the renewed effort of the feds and local authorities, may well start bleeding its way into Nassau County. And you've come up with a suggestion to stop them in their tracks. What is it?
Well, you know what? When you press down on a balloon, it kind of moves everything to the other side. We see it bleeding over into Nassau County, and it's time we pride pressure right here in Nassau County as well. We need to support our law enforcement first and foremost, make sure they have the resources that they need. So I've suggested they appoint a gang czar so that the gang czar can take all the resources, whether it's police department, DPW. The county has $3 billion budget annually. Let's put everything we have into going straight at this gang, coordinating with the federal and state governments. But we have to do more than that. We got to get into the schools through our pop cops, make sure we're in there. We also need to expand our economic opportunities so we can create jobs. Those are years down the road. We have to work on fighting it first and foremost right now and then create an environment so people aren't attracted to gangs. So it's going to take years. It's going to take a multi-pronged approach. But it starts with understanding what this gang is. It is the most savage street gang in the country. They're in our communities. They're killing our kids. And right now I'm fighting against an opponent for county executive who wants to play political correctness when it comes to really taking this to the gangs right now. And, you know, and we're going to take it to her during the next week. I got to tell you, it's embarrassing when you hear about, you know, people talking about this being a race issue or an immigration issue. It's not an immigration issue. It's a public safety issue, and it's about time we treated it that way.
Now, Jack Martins, my concern is also the Nassau County lockup, because even when MS-13 members are locked up, they are active in recruiting, taking over tiers, dominating the gang culture. So this gang czar that you would have appointed if you are elected the new Nassau County executive on November 7th, would they also be overseeing the activity of the gang in the county lockup?
Well, look, every aspect of county government is going to be working together to fight this gang. I've met with the guys who are in the jail, the correction officers. I've met with the sheriff. There is going to be a no-holds-barred approach to fighting gangs, including right in the jail. That's no longer going to be a recruiting place for gangs, certainly, you know, a place where they can go there, recruit, and solidify their control so when they get out. But, yeah, the gang czar is going to have access to all aspects of law enforcement, and that goes right into our jails as well. But I got to tell you, our guys here in Nassau County, our correction officers are doing a great job. They understand the challenges. They need more men. They've been bled dry over the years, and we're going to give them the resources they need to make sure that they can properly handle this gang problem in the jails as well.
Now, Jack Martins, your proposal of a gang czar to deal specifically with Nassau County's growing MS-13 problem, would that, though, also include monitoring 18th Street, the Bloods, the Crips, and the Latin Kings, who have had a good run in Hempstead and Freeport and Roosevelt and other parts of Nassau also?
You know, we talk about MS-13. You're absolutely right, Curtis. This is not just about MS-13. It's about every violent gang that's out there, and certainly all of them are terrorizing local communities. No one has been as, unfortunately, as vicious and savage as MS-13. We've seen the results not only in Suffolk County, but unfortunately bled over into Nassau County with these kids dying. And, you know, that's where our focus has to be. But yeah, every single gang, that's why they're not going to be the MS-13s are, they're going to be the gangs are. They're going to go out there and put every resource we have to making sure not only we find them, we find where they live, we root them out of their communities. And frankly, let's start deporting these guys. Let's start deporting these violent felons. I'm sick and tired of seeing people playing games with violent felons, creating sanctuary cities or sanctuary counties. These politicians who say that they would rather, put political correctness ahead of public safety.
Well, do
we see what happened with these kids dying.
Do appreciate that. That's Jack Martins. He's running on the Republican, Conservative, and Reform Party lines to replace the crook Mangano, the Hazari, the pig. His Democratic opponent is for a sanctuary county. Obviously would not be raining down as tough on MS-13 as Jack Martins. Your choice on November 7th if you want an MS-3 Nassau County.
Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
There's nobody that knows this city better than Curtis Sliwa.
WABCRadio.com.
As we continue on the drive home at 5, one of the favorite parts of this program is when I talk about the geriatric espresso sipping psychotic killers of organized crime in the Curtis Sliwa edition of Mob Talk. It's about mobsters choking on their lobsters. And oh, what a crybaby John Gotti is. Now, which of the many Gottis who are Jadrules, knuckle draggers, who are real Gavones? I'm talking about the grandson of John Gotti Sr. That's right, because now his stepmother has appealed to a judge who's ready to sentence him in November on serious charges of going easy on Johnny Boy, because you don't understand, he's such a good man, such a young man, and because of his name, Gotti, he may be, well, treated like a Maytag in prison. And you know he is. That when he mixes in the general population, if they let him mix in the general population and don't put him in protective custody, Punk City, they're going to eat him up alive. They're going to have his commissary privilege, and he will literally be one of these inmates' Maytags. And who knows? They may pass him around and trade his hood from inmate to inmate. But let me tell you what the situation is. John Gotti, the grandson, was caught selling oxycodone, hillbilly heroin, outside of the tattoo shop that he was a silent partner on in Cross Bay Boulevard in Howard Beach. Then he was dealing out of his grandmother's house. That's right, Victoria Gotti Sr., the wife of John Gotti Sr., dealing oxys right out of the front door with the knowledge of his father, Peter Gotti Jr., who is the son of Victoria. What a putain she is. Anyway, he's dealing hillbilly heroin out of the back door of their house in New Howard Beach and out of the front door of their house in New Howard Beach. And he's looking at an 8-year state sentence. Well, that's a slam dunk deal. And now he's looking at more time because he was a getaway driver in 2002 for Bonanno guy Vinny Asaro. Oh, Vinny Asaro, that's right. Wasn't he part of the Lufthansa heist? Didn't he walk out of jail recently, free and clear, because a Brooklyn jury and federal court in the Eastern District said he's too old of a curmudgeon, he's an altacaca, he won't harm anybody. He claimed he was cut off by a car, and then he wanted to torch the car of the guy who also lived along Cross Bay Boulevard and who dutifully was like, yeah, Vinny, I'll do it. John Gotti, the grandson of John Gotti Sr. So he's looking at a multitude of charges. And so all of a sudden, this woman who has come forward, his step-grandmother, whatever that means, said, hey, look, this young man's brush with the law, Judge, it could be divine intervention from J.C. himself. That's right, JC himself. That's why I'm begging you, beseeching you, please give Johnny Boy a light sentence so that his time in prison is an opportunity for him to turn his life around and it doesn't make him hardened and victimized and institutionalized. Meantime, Asaro, the Bonanno kingpin, who got off of that Lufthansa heist like he was living a new life, he's pled guilty to the same charges and is awaiting a sentence. Wouldn't that be marvelous if both the all-timer, the Altacaca Asaro, and John Gotti, the grandson, were actually cellmates together in Punk City Protective Custody, upstate New York? That would be fitting retribution and revenge for a family whose note in life is to steal, rape, purge, and destroy people by all means necessary. Oofah, John Gotti.